Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled, The Problems of Preservation. How much evidence is too much? My name is Greg Walsh, and I am Assistant Director of Practice Groups, Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Michael Buschbacher, Counsel at the U.S. Department of Justice, Suzanne H. Clark, Discovery Counsel at eDiscovery Co-Counsel, PLLC, and Mr. Robert Keeling, a partner at Sidney Austin, LLP. After our speakers give their opening remarks, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you all for sharing with us today. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Greg. My name is Michael Buschbacher. As Greg mentioned, I'm an attorney at the Department of Justice in the Environment and Natural Resources Division. For that, though, I was a litigator at Sidley with Robert, where I did an interesting mix of appellate and trial work and a lot of e-discovery policy and interesting cases, including one very fun spoliation thing where we caught one of the plaintiffs using Microsoft Word to change the content of email. Robert is gonna lead us off here. Robert, like I said, is a partner in Sidley's DC office, and he's an expert on many e-discovery topics and has written a really interesting law review article that I commend to you all called Sometimes old rules know best, returning to common law conceptions of the duty to preserve in the digital information age, which was in the winter 2018 issue of the Catholic University Law Review. Also, Suzanne Clark is going to be presenting this morning or this afternoon, sorry. She's a graduate of University of Florida College of Law and serves as eDiscovery co-counsel. Serves as Discovery Counsel at eDiscovery Co-Counsel PLLC and has a number of credentials and experience in the eDiscovery realm. The topic for today's discussion is one that I think is both very important and perhaps doesn't get quite the attention it deserves among FedSoc types, and it's discovery, eDiscovery, and preservation in particular. And one of the reasons why I think it's been underlooked at is that generally the scholarship out there has focused on contemporary issues and hasn't looked historically at how our current regime was developed and what came before Rule 37E world that we live in today. Robert's article that I mentioned does a good job of beginning to push back against that, and it raises a number of interesting questions about balancing the need for factual preservation against the increasing burdens of truly enormous amounts of data that defendants, mostly defendants, end up having to preserve, which also increases discovery costs for plaintiffs and has really changed the face of litigation. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Robert to begin, and thanks, Robert.
Sure. Thanks, Michael. So, and thanks, everyone, for getting on the phone today. So just to kind of set the table a little bit, I, as a partner with Sidley, I represent corporate defendants. Suzanne, is who I've had the pleasure of litigating with her firm in the past, typically represents requesting parties. But, you know, broadly speaking, you know, what we both deal with is, you know, data. And in particular, over the past 20 years, that data, as everyone knows, has been increasing really exponentially. You know, traditionally, going back, you know, decades or hundreds of years, preserving documents that maybe relevant to a litigation meant, you know, preserving, you know, like a folder of paper documents or, you know, at most a few boxes. But that is obviously no longer the case. For modern business, kind of the amount of electronically stored information, which we kind of in the industry refer to as ESI, has increased really astronomically. And And there's obviously good business reasons for that, right? So there's a lot of efficiencies and data reasons that, you know, businesses prefer kind of increased communication, increased data. But when you get to litigation, it, you know, creates some issues because it's not just email, which in and of itself has increased over time. You know, when 20 years ago, you might have sent only a handful of emails a day. Now, you know, the average employee will send or receive hundreds, but you also have the information on their laptop, on removable media like thumb drives, and then, of course, information on their phones, social media, and structured data, you know, all of which, you know, could be potential evidence for a case. So when you can't think about preservation, that's kind of what we're thinking of, particularly on the corporate defendant side. So I think Suzanne probably deals with it, you know, as far as your end. That may be a fact, Suzanne, right? But as far as the importance of preservation, right, you might have a different view.
Right. So, you know, we deal with asymmetrical litigation and where we're representing consumers against corporations. So we're looking at, we want preservation so that we can get to the truth and the facts of the case, not end up with not getting our evidence, trials by surprise, protecting citizens, accountability of corporations, even protecting employees of corporations. We want to get the facts. We want to get the data so that we really know what happened. And we want corporations to be accountable for that so that they know that that there will be evidence of how they were acting and what happened in the case.
And government, and I should add, I'm appearing today in my personal capacity, so the usual caveat that what I say isn't the position of the Department of Justice. It's just mine own. But the government sort of stands in two places at once. On the one hand, we're often requesting a party, whether that's in litigation or in an investigation. And we're also the defendant in a lot of matters, and we have to do our own collections and our own preservation of documents and data. And on top of that, there's a lot of coordination that has to go on with the various components and agencies that we represent or are working with. So there's a need both to make things manageable, but also to have the tools that we need to find out what happened.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it creates kind of a issue for the government, but you see both sides from the producing party and the receiving party, right? So that's kind of the point here. We're trying to get from different perspectives, for this discussion. I don't know, Michael or Suzanne, would want to kind of think about, you know, while that's the current issue as far as the current standards that apply for folks, we can help set the table with that.
Sure. I mean, really the reasonable anticipation of litigation standard is ubiquitous now, which requires parties to preserve things that might be relevant or are likely to be relevant to litigation whenever it's reasonable to expect that there might be a case coming at some point in the future that involves those issues. I think Robert will get into how that's a change from how things used to be done, but the upshot of that is of the current standard is that there's an enormous amount of preservation that happens even when there is no case that ends up getting filed. And that preservation often begins a long time before any litigation gets filed, even if it ends up being connected to litigation. And often, certainly it's true in the government, and it's also true with private companies, that there are often data preservation policies in place that sort of preemptively require stuff to be preserved and then have various ways of flagging that for litigation hold if that becomes necessary.
And just from the requesting party's point of view on preservation, is a big theme for us is being, you know, on the outside looking in. So, you know, what is the law? The law is the anticipation of litigation standard. Well, how is that determined? How was that determined at the opposing party corporation? You know, was there a litigation hold policy? Was that litigation hold policy followed? Can we even get a copy of the records retention policy to make sure? Because, you know, we find out down the road if there's a preservation issue. When you look at the electronic discovery reference model, it's at the beginning, identification of information sources and then preservation of those information sources. So it's on the producing parties, it's the onus of the producing party to be doing that correctly. Well, and what I find in my practice, which deals a lot with evidence management on evidence that's incoming, is that we will be told, well, we don't have any data for this particular custodian because they were terminated and then we had a 6-month hold and then we let everything go because our records retention policy says that we just keep things for 6 months after somebody's terminated. So then we're thinking, okay, well, when did you anticipate litigation? When were they terminated? When did the 6 months run out? And there's an analysis that needs to be conducted to see if the evidence was or was not properly preserved or was defensively deleted, yet we don't have the facts to be able to make that assessment. So those are the concerns. So that's why on requesting parties tend to want to maybe over-preserve, is because there's no way for us to make these determinations.
Right. Phrase like bandied about a lot is we don't know what we don't know.
Right.
Exactly. And so for folks, you know, I think maybe a lot of people are familiar with the current standard, which is you have to preserve the reasonable anticipation of litigation. That was made most famous about 20 years ago by a case that there's a lot of consensus on what it held, which is reasonable anticipation of litigation. There's not a lot of consensus on how to pronounce it, which is either Zubilek or Zubilake decision that involved EEOC employment complaint. It's a Southern District of New York case. And there's another number of reasons why this case, you know, there was a series of cases, but there's a number of reasons why those opinions ultimately got famous. In many ways, they had the benefit of being the first that were ruling on these types of issues. And, you know, broadly speaking, you know, the courts, federal courts, tended to then adopt that standard nationally. And it's now even, you know, at least in a commentary into the federal rules. What I found when I was doing research is somewhat surprising to me, actually, is that that was not always the case. And just because this is a FedSoc, I think I should note as an initial matter, of course, historically, discovery was and present. Issues of preservation around discovery was available only for suits in equity. So actions of law were typically dependent on oral testimony, and you had to get court order for discovery in actions of law. But in any event, even in equity, the historical duty to preserve dates back hundreds of years into English common law, and at least to the 1600s or the 1700s. One of the first reported cases was an English case, the Armory matter, involved, of course, a chimney sweep that found a jewel and took it to a goldsmith. And rather than inspect the jewel and quote a price, the goldsmith fraudulently removed the jewel from their setting and basically gave the setting back to the chimney sweep. And then in litigation, the goldsmith sold the jewel. And in litigation, the court basically sanctioned the goldsmith and said, you know, the value of the jewel should be assumed at the jewel at the highest quality, right? And so in the decades and centuries, you know, that followed, you know, the English and American courts elaborated on kind of what the contours of the duty to preserve were. And for our purposes, in English common law and American common law, the courts, you know, held basically that the duty to preserve arose either at the time of the filing of the lawsuit or at most when the lawsuit was imminent, right? which is a very different, you know, standard than reasonable anticipation of litigation. And so you see that, you know, in the cases that that follow, just one more case for you, and because it's an American common law case, of course, it has to deal with railroads. It's called a Bertholdt Jennings Lumber. And there is an Eighth Circuit case involving rates that a railroad could charge. And there the railroad was accused of charging higher rates. And it turns out the railroad had originally maintained receipts, which could have proved that the railroad was violating these statutory rate provisions. But the railroad had destroyed those receipts in the kind of the common course of business. And the ultimate litigation, the court held that no spoliation sanctions should apply because no lawsuit had been filed, and nor was there evidence of bad faith. So, and so it was a common law, basically. So what we've seen is, you know, a different standard, which in some ways is hard to argue against the current standard and say it's not reasonable, right? Because it has reasonable in its name. It's reasonable anticipation of litigation. But, you know, at least from the producing party side, there's a big difference between, you know, certainty of, oh, I have to preserve when a lawsuit is filed, you know, when I've actually got the summons and the complaint against me, or when I know it's like being filed tomorrow, versus, you know, reasonably anticipating that, you know, some type of litigation might be filed against me at some point in the future. So kind of broadly speaking is the, you know, the issue and the common law distinction from the current standard.
And so, Robert, what you're saying is they're taking away the certainty, and it's hard to figure out what this trigger is because it's a subjective analysis of what was happening.
Exactly. And so, you know, practically speaking, it's now a gray area, right? So what is, you know, what may be reasonable to some is, you know, not reasonable to others, right? And so what you see in response, particularly from companies who are repeat litigants, is that they tend to over-preserve. They preserve, you know, more data and earlier than they would otherwise need to under the traditional common law standards. And that relates in costs, that result in costs, not just for storage. And contrary to popular belief, storage is actually pretty expensive when you're dealing with kind of the volumes of some of these companies. When you're dealing with petabytes of data under storage for litigation or regulatory matters. But then the more data that's preserved, the costlier it is to process, you know, review, and produce in litigation.
And I think, you know, from the requesting party side, we just don't think about that, right? I don't really think that's a factor or a tool that's used. Let's increase the cost of litigation for these corporations. We're not thinking that far down the road. We're not thinking of that strategically or trying to use discovery or preservation as a sword. Really, we just want to get the information so that we have the facts, so that we have the data, so that we can then develop our case, learn our case. We don't have any other way to learn the case besides discovery. When you have two corporations against each other and they were exchanging information with each other, then you're probably going to have a lot of the information that you can learn your case from your own client's data sources. And then, yes, you still want to do discovery to see what was happening behind the scenes at the other side. But when you're dealing with consumers and you're dealing with plaintiff's counsel and mass torts and things like that, the consumer doesn't have much data besides social media accounts. And it's not a part of these attorneys' practice to be managing data of their own clients. So they have no clue about, it's just not on their radar about the cost. What we want is we want to get the information. We want to make sure that everything was done defensively and appropriately and reasonably to get us what we're entitled to in the scope of discovery. So I say this, Robert, because I want to say, is there another way to solve this where with agreements between the parties so that you can build in certainty and we can feel on our side more secure that we're going to get what we need? And I mean, what I'm bringing up is later on our topic list, but yeah, preservation orders, preservation agreements, things like that.
Yeah. And exactly. So for folks who might have experience with this, what Suzanne's talking about is, you know, the parties can basically contract themselves and kind of take themselves, you know, in some ways out of the gray area of preservation and come to an agreement about what data should be preserved in a suit and what data should not. And so that it does provide, you know, the certainty to both parties. So the plaintiffs would then, or the requesting parties would know kind of what data will have comfort that, you know, data that's relevant to their suit is being preserved. And the producing parties, the defendants, would have comfort that, you know, information not relevant to the preservation agreement could be deleted. Those are the advantages. From my side, it's rare that I enter into preservation orders, and I certainly would not bring it up in the first instance. The reason, two reasons. One, I don't bring it up because typically if I ask a plaintiff's counsel, well, hey, can we get an agreement about what needs to be preserved? Inevitably, the answer is, well, you should preserve everything. And, you know, that's their starting point, right? And right. The other, you know, and then you have to negotiate from there. The other issue, at least for me, with preservation agreements is that they're typically not agreements, right? They get, they're entered in as an order. So the court, you know, basically blesses the agreement with an order. And then, so what that means is, you know, if we're outside of the agreement, we're kind of litigating about preservation and what should have been done or what shouldn't have been done. At least I have remedies either to the common law or to Rule 37 as far as like safe harbors for me. If it turns out that my folks oftentimes, you know, by accident didn't preserve data that was subject to the preservation order, well, now I'm looking at a show cause. And so it turns up the temperature for me for if I kind of get outside of the preservation order. I don't know, Suzanne, you probably have a different experience with them and maybe a more positive one on your end.
Well, I mean, and I guess it's just a balancing act and just trying to solve this problem that you're identifying here, which as an e-discovery professional and understanding information governance, because that's my job to bring that knowledge to plaintiff's counsel for consumers who don't have a client, they can pick up the phone and call the e-discovery department. And, you know, they come to me to teach them that. So I understand this idea of just mounds and mounds of enormous amounts of data and that is a problem. But it's this residual problem that comes with trying to solve the problem of losing information, and when you look at asymmetrical litigation and, you know, the consumer against the corporation, and with Zubalaki, we're looking at an employee against a corporation. And I read your law review article, and you talk about equity, and you talk about the burden being on the corporation, and the cost and all of that being on the corporation. Well, yes, but the sides are not equal in burden or in resources or in duty. So corporate defendants, they are out there. They are manufacturing, trading, you know, they're part of the economy, they're part of the marketplace, and they're getting a benefit from being in that marketplace. And so there are costs to that. And there is public policy that is in place that says, let's protect the little guy who is, you know, doesn't have a lot of data, yes, but they also don't have a lot of resources to protect themselves. So we need to protect them. And when you get plaintiff's counsel who are willing to come in and willing to invest up front in a matter, they want to know that they're going to get everything they need to prove their case and thus protect these consumers who, if you think about preservation and something like a medical device case, as soon as you're implanting a foreign object into a person's body, you could argue that there are probably going to be lawsuits. If you're implanting these in thousands and thousands of consumers and patients, there probably will be a lawsuit someday. You're doing the testing on these devices well in advance of that. So, you know, implanting a surgeon implanting something versus the testing that was done, and then you have to go through the FDA and regulatory and all of those processes, you're going to need that evidence to find out if anything was done wrong once the lawsuit is filed. So that's my perspective on preservation and the need to keep this data.
Right.
So there's a dysfunctionality I think there are a couple of dysfunctionalities that are getting tossed around. And I think it's important to highlight that one of the problems is that when you're spending someone else's money and there's a benefit that you might get from it, the normal cost benefit analysis you would do goes out the window. So if you're looking at like preserve X, Y, or Z thing, well, chances are, you know, it might be that it's very unlikely that you're going to find anything of relevance there. But nevertheless, it has to be preserved and collected and processed. You know, I worked on, back when I worked at Sibley, I worked on a case where I think in total it was over 14 million documents that were first preserved. I mean, many more were preserved, but first preserved, then processed, reviewed, and then sent out. And then there was a trial, and I think it was around 50 documents got used. Those kinds of, that kind of ratio seems to suggest that there's just a dysfunctionality in spending other people's money. But as you're saying, Suzanne, like there is.
I don't disagree. I absolutely, that is a great argument. And on a practical level, what we say to that when we're at a meet and confer, and I'm just a really practical hands-on in my practice, is let's have transparency. You know, if you're transparent with us about what you're doing, we don't want a data dump because it does cost us money to review also. I mean, it's different, but it still costs us money, including evidence and, you know, case assessment, early case assessment and assessment of evidence costs us a lot of what we call tech time, dealing with rebuilding databases and things like that, identifying gaps, identifying holes, so that we can then go back and say, you know, we don't feel confident you did what we wanted you to do. So there are costs on the receiving party side as well. But what we say is, let's be transparent. Let's work out how you're going to be going through this. Let's see if we can save you money. We don't care, you know, we're okay with you saving money. Just let us know how you're doing this and let us know your processes so that we can be sure we're getting what we want. And I know what you mean, because Robert has talked about when his opposing counsel maybe doesn't understand e-discovery and they want him to preserve everything, you know, you may be sending over this beautiful production that sits on the shelf because the other side doesn't even know how to go through it once they did it. So that matters too, is who your opposing counsel is and things like that.
Yeah. So I think, you know, from, it's all very good points, you know, from a producing party's perspective, you know, what I would say is, you know, if there's a concern from the plaintiff that, you know, there may be an issue with loss of information or loss of data that might be relevant to your suit, well, you have a remedy for that, which is file a complaint, right? And then we can litigate that, and then we can test, you know, the viability of the pleadings and the like. And what's different is, you know, you wait. You might send a preservation letter, which, you know, I tend to think are legal nullities. There are some magistrate judges and court judges that have disagreed with me, but. You know, there could be, you know, months or years that pass before the filing of the complaint. And then after the filing of the complaint, then there's this look back period about, well, you know, I sent you a letter 9 months ago. You know, I'm assuming you moved heaven and earth to preserve data in response to my form letter. And so, you know, I guess that's the point of the common law approach, right, is that plaintiffs are not without remedy. They could avail themselves of the remedy that the law allows, which is to file a complaint, and then the preservation standards would attach at that time.
Yeah, and that's a whole other strategic issue with preservation letters. And, oh, is it, you know, malpractice not to send a preservation letter and go ahead and make sure preservation's happening before you have a chance to file your lawsuit? And then also, the idea, I mean, I've talked to colleagues about this, if they get one of those boilerplate preservation letters, you know, they'll just send a response letter and say, this is what we're going to preserve. We're going to preserve this date range, you know, just identify the scope of preservation in a counter letter so that that other letter can never be used against them. Like you said, it depends on the judge and the court, whether or not, you know, how much weight's going to be given to that. So there's these practical things you can do, you know, to alleviate that risk.
And so I think totally agree. And then I think the, from the producing party's perspective, just to pick off what Michael was saying, is that, I think, when I'm involved in these types of discussions, the discussions around preservation deals with typically the preservation of information, which of course is different from the preservation of evidence. So the evidence may be contained within that information and data, or it may not. And it may be, from wholly other sources or sources that were, properly preserved after the filing of the complaint. But it really is kind of an exercise of information that may contain evidence, and we don't know because we don't have it anymore. And then so it's kind of a guessing game with 20/20 hindsight, when I think everybody understands ultimately, like the point that Michael was making is, you're preserving 10 million documents, but everybody knows only 500 of them are going to be deposition exhibits and only 50 to 150 are going to be trial exhibits. So the other point here is if you're thinking about the common law standard about preserving only when suit is imminent or litigation is filed, at least in my view, you're more likely to focus on what's actually important and what is actually going to be the evidence at trial.
I mean, but you're also getting from when you're assessing a data collection and building your case and building your order of proof as a plaintiff, you're not just looking for your trial exhibits. You're looking for information about who the witnesses are and who your opponents are going to be, who your custodian should be if you feel like they weren't all identified. And so, a lot of information in e-discovery you can get from viewing large quantities of data and running analytics on it, taking large quantities of data and clustering terms, looking at date ranges, looking at spikes in date ranges, having a tool that tells you who was talking to who when, were they conversing with each other after hours, doing sentiment analysis on the data to see where there were contentious relationships or arguments were being had or things like that. So while yes, when you're holding up the document or projecting your document at trial, that's one thing, but there's so much to be obtained from data that isn't actual individual documents that if you are using modern technology to assess the data. So our data now is created with technology, so we need to have tools to assess our evidence, technologically sound tools to assess our evidence as well. You can get a lot of information from large quantities of data that you couldn't if it was really narrow.
Yes, that I hear that. I think from the producing party's perspective, they would say that analysis and the ability to analyze, that the burden to, of course, preserve and produce that data is huge. And the benefit from the analysis of large data sets is typically not known, before you get the data, right? That goes into your, you don't know what you don't know. But the costs tend to be more certain. And we know they're big. And right now that, those costs are typically borne by the producing party. And so, and I haven't yet had a plaintiff, offer to pay for my preservation costs. So... so it does create, different, as Michael said, some disincentives or misincentives, from the parties there.
Now, one of the things we haven't talked about yet that I think is an important part of the whole mix is how spoliation factors into these incentive structures. And Zubilaki tried to move the needle towards making it easier to get sanctions. And since then, revisions to Rule 37E, I think, pushed it back a little. It seems to me that, because it's very hard to police bad behavior, is an area where harsh sanctions are actually a good idea, because when you have something that is hard to find examples of or hard to suss out, when you do find it, if you come down with a very heavy hammer, that changes the calculus for potential bad actors in the future. I'm just curious for both your thoughts on how that factors into thinking about how to minimize over-preservation while making sure that, you know, you're not getting shred parties and other kinds of inappropriate destructions of evidence.
Dan, you want to go first? You want me to go first?
Sure. I was going to ask you. So when it comes to, you know, practical aspects of how does the law and spoliation law impact my actual practice? You know, whenever we are making some sort of discovery motion to the court from our point of view, whether that's motions to compel or spoliation or anything like that, we're not just thinking about, okay, let's analyze the case law. I mean, that's, you know, we're also thinking about what's the practical implication of this? How much time is this going to take us? How much, you know, what's the opportunity cost here? How else can we solve this problem? What is the judge going to think about us? How is this going to turn out for us in court? Because just because the law looks like it might be in our favor and we think we could win this motion, there's always the risk that we might not. So we balance that with, okay, there is data missing. We're missing these custodians. They tell us, you know, they terminated them and that they defensively deleted their accounts. Okay, are we going to take our time to go to court and be outward facing on it? Or are we going to take the data that was provided to us and that was produced to us from other custodians and try to rebuild and recreate data and do an evidence-based tactic for this? So I don't know if that's exactly what you were asking, but, you know, because I know Robert's answer and what the producing party's perspective is, but just from a requesting party, that's my perspective on spoliation. It's, do we want to duke it out in court? Can we prove this? How hard is this going to be? How much is this going to cost? Versus, is there a way to get what we need without having to go that route?
Yeah. So at least on the producing party, that, you know, the changes to the federal rules in December 2015 were helpful, but they don't, you know, get us fully back to the protections of the historical common law, right? Because, you know, Rule 37E, it doesn't have bright lines, right? It just says, if I'm paraphrasing, but if ESI should have been preserved in the anticipation or conduct of litigation because a party failed to take reasonable steps to preserve it, but didn't, you know, then there's these steps. So in some ways, it somewhat, you know, the word anticipation litigation is in 37E now. It's not in Rule 26 or otherwise, but in some ways, the rule could be read to adopt the modern common law standard. You know, but while there are protections, there are still no bright lines about, like, when the duty attaches and the timing of that, and then what is reasonable versus what is not reasonable, and what is reasonable steps to preserve information, right? So it's not just anticipation, but it's also when does a party anticipate litigation? But, you know, this phrase of reasonable steps now in Rule 37E, of course, it's the same problem, right? Because, again, while the word reasonable is right there, that's kind of meaningless when you're actually faced with a set of facts and trying to make decisions about what information to preserve versus what information not to preserve. And, you know, still, I think many, at least corporate entities, are erring on the side of preservation a lot of times when they didn't need to. If others have final thoughts, or should we open it up for questions?
I think I said everything I needed to say.
All right. How about questions?
All right. We'll go to questions now. We'll go to our first question here.
It's David Emerson, the Federalist Society chapter in Berkeley. I'm usually on the receiving end of the discovery requests in most of my experience. And I'd like to get thoughts from the panelists, and I do appreciate you're both very seasoned and you're quite astute, about the impact that shifting to you know, the prevailing party approach to litigation costs, or the English rule versus the American rule, cost shifting in general, and whether or not you, either of you, have experience, either directly or indirectly, with jurisdictions that have taken that approach, and whether they're still seeing this kind of vexatious problem with the high expense of discovery and the issues with preservation.
Sure, I can go first. I do have experience with this, just with my in multinational litigation and working with my colleagues in our UK office. I have been involved in suits in the UK and helped, you know, on the e-discovery aspects of that, and have one of those matters. We were able to get costs. You know, wasn't as much cost as, because we prevailed, it wasn't as much cost as we would have liked, but you know, it was. I think it does act as, you know, a deterrent in some respects, certainly against more of the frivolous or vexatious type of litigation. And, you know, from my perspective, we don't even need to probably go to the full, you know, kind of English system or UK system. For me, certainly in big cases, for me, even only recovering 5% of my costs, I think would, you know, give more than sufficient skin in the game to the other side, frankly, partly because my cases tend to be larger. But even 5%, I think, would really align interests and make the parties very reasonable. Just one more anecdote. You know, I after the rules were passed, I was able to I had already given discovery. Plaintiffs wanted more. I said no. We took it to the magistrate. The magistrate said, well, you plaintiffs can have more discovery, but given all the discovery that they've received so far, they have to pay for it. Well, you'd be shocked and surprised about how reasonable the plaintiffs suddenly became as far as the scope of the supplemental discovery as compared to their original discovery request. So I do think it matters, and I do think it could be helpful, but I think even really a percentage would have the same effect. Suzanne, you probably have a different view.
Well, I mean, I think that there are factors to be weighed and balanced, and that if you weigh and balance those factors, that it is appropriate at times to shift costs and share costs. And I think it does. I'm a big proponent of accountability and accepting and sharing burden, like with transparency and, you know, understanding. Now, you know, and the factors that you're going to weigh are who has control over these costs. I mean, there is a cost shifting analysis in the Zubalaki opinions, and she goes through it there. And I think that makes a lot of sense. That's how we practice law, is we say, you know, what's equitable, what's right here, and look at all these factors. Look at ability to pay, look at who's in control of the cost. You know, if we're talking about doc review or something like that, and the, you know, producing party is saying, I want you to pay for some of my doc review, and then they're using partners and associates to review documents instead of contract attorneys, you know, all of these things need to be weighed.
Yeah, but good question.
Yeah, that's a great question, yes.
It looks like we don't have any questions right now in the queue. Would any of you like to give closing remarks, and maybe we'll wait for a question to pop up if it does?
Sure. I think I give one remark in the sense that, you know, I've had, to Suzanne's point, you know, there are ways where this can be done cooperatively and in ways that can reduce costs. You know, I've litigated with Suzanne's colleague on a medical device case before, and, you know, it was all very collegial and constructive. You know, the issue perhaps motivating my law review article is, you know, that's not always the case, certainly not always the case in my experience as well, personal experience. And, you know, the issue with kind of setting broad rules is to try and, you know, capture as many, kind of set behavior for as many cases as possible. And at least the, you know, from my view, the historical rule provided more certainty, certainly to producing parties. And so therefore, at least should be given consideration, you know, for going forward.
Thank you, Robert. That was nice of you to, we do try to cooperate and be transparent. And the way I see it is, when it comes to data and evidence, it's very black and white. It's very fact-based. I think that with e-discovery attorneys, you can get a lot of cooperation and transparency because both sides understand that. You know, if we really get to the data and the facts, we can find a way to make this work. We can find a way to control costs. We can, you know, we can reduce the number of custodians. We can do a sampling. We can, you know, there's just so many ways that if you work together, you can control the cost of the data, this non-merit-based side of litigation. And I think a big part of that is bringing in people who understand data. Because on either side, if you're dealing with somebody who doesn't have competency in e-discovery, if as a producing party, you're dealing with a side who says, I want everything because they don't understand, or on the receiving party, if we're dealing with people who don't understand how to properly collect metadata and process it. And, you know, we're getting all these blank metadata fields and we're having to go back and we're having to ask for things to be redone. And it can be very messy and time consuming and expensive. So when you get knowledgeable people on both sides who really understand electronically stored information and evidence and who can work together and are allowed to work together and not use it as a sword, everybody comes out better in the end.
So we've actually gotten two questions in the meantime. Would you like to take them?
Sure.
Yeah.
Great.
Good afternoon. Fascinating topic. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to read the law review article, and I apologize if you covered some of this. I'm just curious, in our cloud-based world now, to what extent some of these cost considerations could be addressed with interesting privacy implications, given how much information is already contracted out, stored by big data, and or maybe collected on us on firms and so forth, not entirely with their consent. And I'm just curious what your perspectives on that might be.
Sure. It's a great question. So in many ways, the move of data to the cloud, it's kind of the same thing we've experienced 20 years ago, just all over again, where there's innumerable business reasons for moving data to the cloud. It's cheaper, it's faster, and there's a lot of business benefits. As a result, more data is being stored. And so it results in, you know, even more and more data being subject to litigation. And so you have those kind of downstream costs of processing and review and production. And to your point about privacy, that is certainly the case. There's not a sufficient focus on kind of the burdens of protecting privacy by producing parties, some of them who have obligations to do so, right? A pharma or medical device company may have obligations to protect, PII, and that can be very difficult in a litigation and very expensive. And so there's it does create, you know, one, a lot of business efficiencies, but it can create some complications in terms of preservation, certainly.
Let's go to our next question now. Caller area code 703, you have the floor.
Hi, this is Mike Doherty. I'm involved in some civil matters, one of which was a QTAM in the Southern District of New York, where everyone knew, and everyone still knows, that the whole devil's in the data. There is no case if we don't get our hand on the data, and the entire case is proved if we get our hand on the data. Therefore, in a civil matter and in the QTAM and other cases, opposing counsel, of course, did anything they could to stay on the football so it didn't turn into a nuclear bomb. And the Justice Department was not interested, and the judges were not interested. And as a matter of fact, I think the Justice Department wasn't interested because if it blew up, it would kind of blow up on them as well. So I'm curious about what you see as far as judicial discretion in killing e-discovery access, because we actually would have paid for everything because I had insurance money that would have paid for all their costs, but they just weren't going to let it out no matter what. And the judges kind of, and the Justice Department went along to get along. And so now we're at the appellate process. So that's my question.
sure probably you found a receptive audience with Suzanne. I don't know if you, Suzanne, you want to respond to that first, then I can, or I'm happy to respond.
You go ahead.
Sure. So, you know, what you say, you know, I certainly hear from requesting parties where there's kind of view that, you know, the litigants on the receiving end are not fully, you know, producing sufficient information or the information that they should produce in the suit. And that may be added, you know, in the QTAM situation by the government with their attention or lack of attention that they want to spend on a particular case. And, you know, I think certain, so it's hard because certain cases, obviously, it's well warranted, right? And there may be some gamesmanship going on. But, you know, at least as the producing party, my issue is a number of the rules that have been made are somewhat anecdotally based. And, you know, from my perspective, you know, trying to comply with these requests and counseling companies who are trying to, you know, do the right thing and comply with their obligations, you know, I just see a lot of costs on the other end where there's a lot of money being spent to preserve and produce for data that's never looked at and never used. And so, you know, what you're articulating is on the other side of the coin, right? Which is, you know, the other side not and going to great lengths to kind of avoid production, which, you know, look, creates its own issues. And you know, I think the traditional response is, you know, well, you have to, you know, see, that's what the judge is for. But I hear, you know, what you're saying is, you know, the judge was not, you know, interested in perhaps giving relief, which creates, you know, certainly a frustration. But, you know, for me, I guess the difference is, you know, the individual case versus the policy level. And at the policy level, you know, certainly from a producing party side, I see that, you know, less preservation being, you know, favorable from a societal point of view rather than greater preservation.
And Robert, what about, you know, this idea that Mike's trying to take away the cost issue?
Yeah.
And, you know, clearly there's other reasons that they didn't want to produce besides just cost. So does that impact judges? If, you know, if you're going in to say, because we don't normally do that,
yeah.
We don't normally say we'll pay for it all. And I'm, you know, but there's so many other factors besides just cost.
Right.
I don't know how much that relieves or changes the story if you're willing to pay for it.
Yeah. No, I think
we never offer that. So.
No, I know. I think the answer to that is my favorite e-discovery response, which is it depends.
Right.
And you know, there's some cases where the question of production versus non-production is really a cost issue. And so therefore the offer to at least assume some or all of the cost should resolve the issue. And there's others where, you know, there's collateral reasons why you wouldn't want to produce that is separate from costs. There's not a lot of court decisions on this. There are one or two that say, well, look, you know, the offer to assume the costs is relevant but not determinative. But, you know, then unfortunately there isn't a lot of, because it's not done in the normal course, there's not a lot of case law to provide clear guidance about what, you know, should be done in that situation.
Seems to me, just as a general observation, that it's unfortunate that we don't have more judicial engagement generally in discovery. And, you know, we have magistrate judges, but it seems like they're not interested in doing discovery things either, which I get because it can be messy and boring. But I think that's one of the ways in which a lot of these things can be addressed is by building a body of case law and not just having sort of unguided discretion.
Yes, agreed.
Okay, I'll offer a call for any last closing remarks. You already gave excellent closing remarks for 10 minutes ago, but if anyone wants to add anything before we close out, go ahead now.
Thank you very much for inviting me to be a part of this. I really enjoyed it.
Yes, agreed. Thanks, everyone.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you all. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you all for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. And we'll have another telephone call here in 30 minutes back at the same number on the Trump v. Mazars and Trump v. Vance cases that came down today. Thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.